Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 23rd, 2002. Today's session is titled Globalization, Freedom, and Democracy, Friends or Foes, presented by Cynthia Molavita. And the session number is MOC 2002-08. Let's listen in.
I'm Cynthia Molavita, and this is the fourth in our series of five sessions looking at the call to love neighbor as self in our current context of a form of economic globalization that, whether we like it or not, and against our best instincts and against our desires to live lives that love neighbor as self, a context of globalization that demands us to live in ways which are brutal, result in brutal, have brutal consequences for many of our neighbors, both human and other. Now, this is the overall picture that we're looking at. Just a show of hands of folks that have not yet been to any of these sessions in this series.
Oh, Emily,
two or three, okay. Then I do want to contextualize it just a little bit, because we do have a few new people. And before we do, let us remember one of the earliest comments, and that is that we're looking at realities that are profoundly difficult to see. Anytime we look at ways in which our lives serve to, well, the word brutalize comes to mind, and brutalize other people's lives, it's hard to look. And it's an act of courage, and it's an act of wisdom and faith to see. I was talking with the village artist this evening about the power of seeing, and that when we dare to see more clearly what is around us, we must do so also claiming the promises of God. And one of those promises is that God will meet us and be with us and lead us forward into ways of love. That is, we're not called to love neighbor as self if we're not also empowered to do so. As a symbol of hope and of the holy ground that we walk on, when we dare to see for the sake of being faithful, we light a candle. And how splendid that it can sit in the midst of these awesome figures. When my kids are acolytes, they're always afraid that the light won't light. I tell them, don't worry, people will accept you anyway.
But they aren't afraid that they're going to set anything on fire.
That is it. I have permission to light this candle. We will blow it out afterwards, believe me. I had asked people to bring signs of hope that you find in your day-to-day life around the village. Has anyone done so?
Yeah, I brought pine cones.
Pine cones.
And I tried to find pine cones that are, still have seeds in them.
Thank you.
I brought my leaves today.
Pardon me?
I brought my leaves.
Oh, you did. And what did you bring?
Well, I brought pictures of my grandchildren.
Oh,
my
wonderful.
Signs of hope.
Oh, and Alex brought
the baby.
Thank you. Since you don't have the pictures today, we have a
polite grandchild.
Yes. And I brought the Harpers actually yesterday, but that was because there were some articles about things, and I thought, oh yes, now more people will know the problem.
So you brought this journal.
Yeah.
Which has an article about globalization.
Yes.
And you see that as a sign of hope because it what?
Because it educates people, and more people will know the problem. More people will know because it's a mass communication that gets to more people in this place, obviously.
Okay. Thank you. I'll leave it out here also for people to look at. Thank you for bringing that. It's funny because it's the day after I asked people to bring signs of hope. The next day, these incredible figures appeared in the midst of us, which are also a sign of hope. Do please remember that and bring symbols and signs of hope tomorrow. I want to say that, and we'll talk more tomorrow about situating this inquiry in the context of Christian ethics as a particular disciplined art in the life of Christian people. But the one thing I would say, what did I want to tell you about Christian ethics? Hope. Signs of, I remember. The one thing I want to say is that any inquiry into social injustice or ecological injustice that is tremendously systemic and in which our lives are intimately engaged, from my perspective as a Christian ethicist, needs to be an inquiry with an end purpose beyond our efforts to understand. The end purpose is moral and spiritual power. So we attempt to see more clearly, to understand, to know, not for the purpose of knowing and seeing alone, but for the purpose of enabling ourselves to be people of moral and spiritual power to live toward justice-making love. So let that be a brief orientation to what we've done thus far. The first day was an overview. The second day was really a look at what are the dynamics constitutive of economic globalization. The third day, which was yesterday, I asked you to think about what it is, what on earth would enable compassionate, good, caring, intelligent, educated people to agree to comply with, to acquiesce to ways of life that have dramatically death-dealing impacts on other people. And we've talked about some of those impacts. We're not going to go back into that now. What would enable us to go on with ways of economic injustice? I suggested to you that one dynamic that enables us to go on is ideas, things that we believe, beliefs that we hold uncritically. And last week we looked at one of those. Yesterday we looked at one of those, and that was our beliefs about economic growth. And we sort of dissected the theory undergirding economic globalization. It's a two-clause theory. The theory that one, economic globalization oriented around free trade and investment, economic globalization oriented around free trade and investment makes for economic growth. Part two, growth increases the well-being of everyone. And we dissected that theory and found the fault lines in it. Today, I would like us to look at another set of beliefs. And that set of beliefs has to do with how we understand democracy and freedom, what we understand them to be, but more specifically, how we do or do not understand the relationship between them and the globalizing, global free markets, free trade and investment. So, with that said, let's just take a look at democracy and the not democracy. Let's take a look at some of the implications on democratic processes and tendencies, the implications of economic globalization for those. I'd like us to look at a case study, and it's a case study that we alluded to and touched on a little bit yesterday, but didn't go into in any kind of depth. It's a case study that I searched for. I believe that when there are economic realities so big that it's hard to get a picture of them, that if you find a window, and if you look through a particular window that's easier to understand, if it's a good window, that is, if it illuminates the whole, then you can get a better picture of the whole. The window through which I suggest that people look at economic globalization for the purpose of seeing it more clearly is the window of the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, the MAI, before we look at that, I want you to think just a minute about democracy. What do you understand to be keystones or cornerstones of democracy? Throw out some things.
Free speech?
Individuality.
Free speech. Representative government.
What does that mean?
A government in which leaders are chosen by the people.
Chosen by the people.
Elected by the citizens.
Okay. Thank you.
One person, one vote.
One person, one vote. What's the meaning behind one person, one vote?
That everyone has a chance to choose who their leaders are.
Okay.
Or have a voice.
Okay. Let's think about the vote as being one aspect of democracy, but not all of democracy. Let's think about the vote as being essential to, but not necessary for, democracy. We often think of democracy as just the right to vote. But you said something else. You said one person, one vote. And there's a deeper implication to that.
Equalization of power.
Yeah. Equalization of power. Who said that? Did you say that? I would suggest that one fundamental cornerstone of democracy is relative equality amongst people in power to determine, to participate in decision making about decisions that affect our common life together. Now that's, I'm elaborating, you said one person, one vote. That suggests relative equality in major decisions, the decisions that shape our common life together. In particular, decisions that impact who's going to have food, who's going to have water, who's going to have education, etc. Could we hold that up as one cornerstone of democracy, that relative equality? Yes.
I would suggest, though, that there are some areas that affect us hugely, and in which there are other unseen interests that really do the shaping, notably income tax, which is shaped by lobbying groups and large interests, and we as individuals are not informed, we don't understand, and we don't decide.
Okay, that comment is very helpful. And in one way, to clarify what I asked, I really was asking, you're saying that democracy in that sense, in that area, doesn't necessarily exist.
Yes.
And what, I thank you for that, because my question was, in our ideals, normatively speaking, what are cornerstones of democracy? Not necessarily do we have those ideals.
I'm with you.
Okay, so ideally, relative equality in power.
I would add that on right to assemble.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Others?
Rule of law.
Rule of law, okay, thanks.
Freedom of the press.
Freedom of the press, okay.
Freedom of religion.
Okay, thank you.
Checks and balances.
Checks and balances. What's behind checks and balances?
Well, I'd say it's
the three branches of government.
Okay, and the idea that no one part can take over and run with it, that there are going to be pieces trying to keep things in balance so that you don't get, you know, a presidential dictator who goes out of control.
Okay. Going back, Karen, to
what that we all passed off on.
Okay, this is good. Karen, going back to what you said earlier also, you said something about representative government.
Right.
Now, think about what's behind representative government. Let me suggest that one thing behind it, and a cornerstone of democracy is a sense that power must be accountable. Mm-hmm. That power must be accountable to the broad public. And therefore we have representative government supposedly representing the broad public rather than, say, a monarchy that doesn't represent the broad public. You've named a lot of the systems and institutions through which ideals of democracy are lived out. Bear in mind two of the undergirding principles that we've just now noted related to those systems. One being relative equality amongst of power in decision making that affects the common life together, and second, relative accountability of power. That power has to be accountable to the broader public. Just hold those two in mind. Is that, can you do that? Okay. Hold them in mind as we read a little bit about the MAI, as we discuss it a little bit. Let me give you two paragraphs of background. This background is simply to tell you, this is just to say what this treaty was. Is and why I understand it to be a microcosm, or not really a microcosm, the latest and most powerful manifestation of corporate and finance-driven globalization. lighting is so bad. The MAI, Multilateral Agreement on Investment, was negotiated in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that is the OECD, from May 95 through late 98, in relative secret until 1997. Congress didn't know about it. Its purpose, according to both supporters and detractors, was to make it easier for individual and corporate investors to move assets, money or production facilities, across international borders. Remember when we talked about the constituent dynamics in economic globalization, and one was increasing trade and investment across international borders, and another was movements to make that cross-border movement easier. That was the purpose of the MAI. The MAI would accomplish that goal by limiting the legal ability of governments at all levels, local, state, provincial, national, limiting the ability of governments to regulate both foreign investment and the activities of foreign-based corporations. The MAI was permanently halted in the OECD by coalitions of civil society groups, led by the French and the Canadians, who brought under scrutiny the alarming impact that the agreement could have on environmental protection, cultural integrity, and human and labor rights. While the MAI was one specific agreement, the term is now widely used throughout the globe to denote the whole agenda of trade and investment liberalization, particularly investment liberalization, currently being pursued in other venues, especially the World Trade Organization, period. So the MAI was a treaty, it was put down. A treaty under negotiation, it was put down, but they say it's like a turtle. Well, not like a turtle, whatever that animal is that crops up in another place with a new shell. It is now being intimately considered and integrated into the WTO. The MAI aspects of the WTO were one of the chief aspects being protested in Seattle. Do you remember that when the Seattle protests were going on? A lot of the protest, if you read it, was about these investment clauses that were in the MAI. Okay. Advocates of the MAI claim basically that by adopting this agreement, trade and investment can flow more freely, which will enhance economic growth around the world, and that economic growth will benefit all people, the theory undergirding it. Opponents of the MAI argued that it would increase the gap between rich and poor. A lot of people would get richer, others would get poorer. That it would abolish a great deal of the ability of governments to protect the environment, and that it would threaten cultural diversity and integrity. Those were three of the main cries by people opposing the MAI. Actually, the French were really opposing it because of the concerns about cultural imperialism from U.S. culture. Yes.
Did it also allow for child labor within the United States because it superseded the bar laws against child labor?
Wow. Now that could have been an implication of it.
That was something discussed. Uh-huh.
What I'd like to do is just dissect with you a little bit three provisions in the MAI, and have you think about the impact they have on the democratic tendencies, accountability and equality, that we just talked about. Just think about how these three clauses would impact key cornerstones of democracy. One of the clauses, and then we'll talk about this, I just want to put it out to you. One of the clauses is called the National Treatment Clause. Are many people in here aware of the MAI? Did you work on it? A lot of people did. Seattle declared itself an MAI-free zone. Denver did. British Columbia did. Many local governments around this continent did. One of the clauses, the National Treatment Clause, would have this impact. I've never read with such bad light. Well, my eyes are just a lot worse. A little bold. The National Treatment Provision, according to that provision, governments at all levels have to treat foreign investors as favorably as domestic investors. Now, y'all, this might sound like just rattle, rattle, rattle jargon, but this stuff is stuff that would implicate everyday life in our towns. In the pre-MAI world, laws distinguishing between local and foreign business enabled governments to promote small local business or business owned by economically marginalized people, or even medium-sized local business, and allow governments to protect natural resources. This provision in the MAI would allow foreign corporations to sue governments, including local governments like city governments, the government of Wenatchee, for those laws on the grounds that they discriminate against foreign business. In other words, right now, Wenatchee could protect business in Wenatchee by giving some favorable provisions, say tax breaks or whatever, to local business. The MAI would allow a large foreign-based corporation to come in and sue the government of Wenatchee for those provisions that favor local business. Did you follow that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can someone flesh out an implication of that for me? Give me an example. What could be an implication?
We talked about the thing up in British Columbia, like up there with the oil or the I guess there was a fishing one where foreign investors came in and they were fishing off of the coast of British Columbia, and it was under the MAI. It should be theirs as well as anybody else's up there to go fish there because that was where the best fish were. So they ended up suing the court of, I can't remember where it was.
In British Columbia.
Yeah. So.
And they won.
Yeah.
And they won?
Yeah.
So that was probably under NAFTA, because if it already happened, that's a very good example. That would have been under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Right.
Yes.
So I see that the MAI, it's the same, I mean, it all comes under the same umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So
it's like NAFTA, but worldwide.
Right.
And NAFTA was primarily trade-related, and the MAI goes over and covers investment as well as trade. Another example that was highly brought up and was the cause of concern was around mining. This provision in the MAI would allow a foreign mining company to give a foreign mining company equal access to, say, minerals on indigenous lands, on a tribal land, and could do the mining and have no requirements to hire any number of local people in management or to do anything to enhance the community, but could repatriate all of the profits. The MAI would allow that kind of thing. So the question that is raised for me in that is, what does that do for the power of governments, locally, state, and nationally, to do what governments are supposed to do, which is protect the interests of their people and their resources, especially vulnerable people and vulnerable resources? Yes?
Well,
Kathy.
They lose a tax base, so they wouldn't be able to provide social services or education services or whatever. You know, if the foreign people are coming in, making money and taking them out.
Uh-huh.
And they would also control the economic environment.
Okay. That's an example I hadn't thought of. Thank you. Yes.
And those foreign investment companies would not be accountable to anybody.
Okay. Who would they be, if they have an impact on the local environment, to whom would they be accountable? Shareholders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But what power does that give the community, the people, to do what people are supposed to do, which is protect the well-being of a community and the health of a community?
That's what the land codes, the zoning ordinances are for. You're going to have local governments going to continue to have control over what gets built and where it gets built through the zoning ordinance.
When I read the MAI, or when the lawyers that I listened to read it, and then subsequently I read it, this agreement would give large foreign corporations the right to challenge local zoning laws.
They might be able to challenge them, but they would, just as any other corporation. There was a recent West Supreme Court case that came out of development out of Lake Tahoe, where they allow a moratorium on construction, but only for a certain period of time. But a lot of that has to do with how, what kind of restrictions government can place upon the use of property.
So I suppose then one of the things we think about when it comes down to a government, a local government without resources, without the monetary resources to defend itself when challenged in court by a foreign corporation, what happens to that? What happens in that case? An example that I would hold up is, you wanted to say something, and then let me give an example.
Well, I mean, to say that the zoning ordinances are all well and good, and it works reasonably well in this country because you have a large middle class and people are educated, and they'll pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. You take some country in which you've got a little bit less than a democracy, mm-hmm. and a foreign corporation can buy out anybody they want at the, mm-hmm. with the drop of a hat. So much for your zoning ordinance is protecting any of the local people. It's just not there. Of course, in many of those countries, it isn't there anyway.
Yeah, though. Yeah.
But if there uh-huh. is something there, it's uh-huh. going to be very easy to buy it out.
So the problem would be where there are protections and the capability of maintaining those protections, this is a multilateral agreement that could threaten those protections. One example, and then let me call on you, let me give one example that has already happened. Do you all remember the Nestle boycott? Do I need to explain what the Nestle boycott
is? Can you remind us?
Okay, in the Nestle boycott, largely, it was a global movement, largely led by people of faith, that realized that Nestle was advertising in countries where many people are illiterate. Nestle was advertising for women to give their babies infant formula instead of breast milk. And the problem with that is that infant, I've been a missionary in Honduras, I worked with mothers and babies, and infant formula can kill babies because it's made with water. And a lot of women don't have access to clean water, or don't know how to boil water, or don't boil water because they don't have the resources to boil water, so their babies get infant formula with water with little animalitos, what?
Bacteria.
And then it's very negative on the health of young people. And the problem with the advertising is that a lot of it was done without words, just pictures, like big, healthy, beautiful babies drinking formula, and then scrawny little teeny weeny babies drinking breast milk. And so the mother says, well, I'll use every resource I have to buy infant formula, and then, okay. A worldwide boycott went on to get Nestle to stop that advertising, and basically was successful. How many people were here involved in that? Basically was successful, and Nestle backed out of that. Well, one of the countries in which that success happened was Guatemala. And Guatemala passed a law banning the advertising of infant formula by pictures to illiterate populations. And that law was in place for some years. Under the new WTO, the World Trade Organization, this clause, or another clause that is in the MAI, which is also beginning, is being proposed for the WTO, allows corporations to sue governments for actions that will minimize corporate profit. That's called the ban. It's a ban on expropriated, on uncompensated expropriation of assets. Basically, if a government is doing something that will diminish assets or profit of a corporation, then the corporation can sue the government. So Gerber threatened to take the government of Guatemala to court because it was diminishing its profits. The government was diminishing Gerber's profits by banning the advertising of infant formula by pictures. No, this is Gerber. Nestle's out of the picture now. This is Gerber, more recently. This is in the last 2 or 3 years. Guatemala, not having the resources to fight it in court, backed off. And now Gerber can advertise with pictures to sell infant formula in Guatemala.
Do you
follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I brought that example up to talk about the difficulty of bringing up legal protection, the difficulty of a government doing that that doesn't have the economic resources to do it. What that turns out to be an example of is another clause in the MAI, which is the ban on uncompensated expropriation of assets.
Okay.
So the question that comes out of that is, what is the capacity then of a government to be accountable to its people? And where is power? Is power equally shared in that kind of decision, or is it not? And so what are the implications for democracy? That's the question I'm raising there. Now, that was long. You had your hand up, and then you had your hand up.
Well, I'm not sure this still fits, but yes. One of the mechanisms government has used in order to attract industry, mm-hmm. particularly clean mm-hmm. industry, mm-hmm. is to offer a tax base, a reduction or a delay mm-hmm. in that, provided they hire X number of people at this this mm-hmm. Wage range mm-hmm. or this period of time, mm-hmm. to give these incentives. And if, I suppose all of that would go away under these sorts of clauses because the company probably would try to dictate something favorable to them.
Under another, what do we call these? They're not clauses, they're provisions. Under another provision in the MAI, yes. Now, of course, it might be contested, but we already know that even the U.S. has lost some of its some U.S. laws have already been challenged in the World Court, and the U.S. has already lost.
Isn't any government can do it by force? I mean,
by force?
Like you say, even if the law,
uh-huh. yes,
you know, says
yes.
Well, we're going to live by this law. I mean, this is the yes. way we're going to do it, and you're out.
Good point. Very good point. The result is penalties, monetary penalties, but also trade-related penalties. And a small government, for the U.S. to get penalized by the World Court is one thing. For a tiny little country to be penalized by the World Court could be enormously destructive. Let me go in order here, though. We had two hands in the back and then right over here. Otto?
No.
All right.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Well, in Texaco ran into kind of an interesting problem in Africa. I believe it was in Chad, uh-huh. where they were trying to operate their pipelines. They were pulling a lot of resources out, and they were trying to get some. The locally neighboring tribes were trying to get some resources from Texaco, schools and healthcare and things like this. Uh-huh. And there was some rebel movement going on, some threats, and they weren't successful. Finally, the women, mothers with babies, uh-huh. came and occupied the pumping stations in the uh-huh. early hours during shift change, uh-huh. just came and moved in uh-huh. with their children. Uh-huh. And they wouldn't leave until they signed papers uh-huh. and started projects that uh-huh. would hire their people, uh-huh. put in health care, uh-huh. bring in schools. And then they would, once that was taken care of to their satisfaction, they would go away.
Now that's a fascinating story because there is it sounds to me, not knowing that particular story, like a manifestation of what's going on in many places of the globe, of very, very grassroots people standing up and saying, this can't happen without particular provisions being in place. In other words, this can't happen, this kind of foreign engagement in our resources can't happen without us setting up certain things that make it good for our people and for our land. There are a number of examples like that. I'm not familiar with that one at all. There was another hand. I believe it was you, yes.
I just have a question. Who's enforcing this? I mean, uh-huh. how can a U.S. corporation uh-huh. tell Guatemala what, you know, I mean, you mentioned a world uh-huh. court, but uh-huh. who enforces that?
This was under the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization has a panel of trade experts that hear cases in the World Court. I mean, not in the World Court, cases that are brought to the World Trade Organization. And the hearings, this is true, y'all, I could bring it to you in print. The hearings are not transparent. In other words, they're closed hearings. They're not transparent to the public. There are usually three, what do we call the people on the panel? I can't remember the technical word. Pardon me?
Magistrates?
Maybe so. I don't remember the technical word. Usually three. And the decisions are not contestable.
Who selects these three people?
I want to piggyback off his question. How strong is the WTO at this point? How much power do they really have? Because I don't really know how many of their rules are in place such that, you know, they can... Because the WTO, as far as I know, is relatively, a lot of the things that they do is secretive and not, doesn't include everybody. Not, your country doesn't have a say, but your country can be totally affected.
But it's not democratic.
Right,
and there's
But I'm just wondering just how far are they in their process? I know they're not to the point where they have taken over, but...
The MAO is constantly it's in development. In other words, for instance, investment-related provisions are in the process of being brought into the WTO. At this point, well, y'all, have you heard stories about cases before the WTO and their resolution? Yes.
Bill Moyers, 2 weeks ago on his program Now, views on PBS, he addressed this with Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader said that he offered to anyone in the Senate and the Congress $1,000 if they'd read these agreements through. No one had. One of them did read it through after he offered that and voted against it, because he was talking apparently about these two clauses that are in both NAFTA and the WTO.
The two clauses?
Yeah, and that must be what he was speaking of.
The question was, how powerful are they? In a certain sense, that's still unraveling. The cases that I know of, one of the most recent cases, and I don't know a lot of the cases, one of the most recent cases I know was, are you familiar with the Caribbean banana industry? The Caribbean banana industry is very different than the Central American banana industry. The Caribbean banana industry is largely owned and run by fairly locally small-scale banana farming. In Central America, banana industry is largely owned by large fruit companies. What are some of the fruit companies? And in the Caribbean, historically, banana workers have had a relatively economically, lives have been good. People have been paid enough and people make a living on their banana work in the banana plantations. In a certain sense, banana industry has been like the social welfare of the country, because people live a reasonable life on it. That's been made possible because England has a long history of quotas through which they buy the majority of their bananas from the Caribbean. Do you follow me? So the Caribbean has a banana market, and the people can get enough money for their bananas to support their life. Well, one of the most recent issues in the World Court was the banana companies that grow their bananas in Central America wanted the British market. So they took it to the World Court, to the WTO, and asked for a ruling that said that England's quotas were non-WTO compliant. Now, at the very time that was happening, I was working in, what was the context of that? I was working in Geneva in New York with a group of people from the World Council of Churches working with the UN on some of the projects to reduce poverty. And one of the women was a very dynamic former Roman Catholic sister who was working with women's groups in the Caribbean. And she said that this WTO ruling, if it passed, was going to destroy lives of people in the Caribbean because they could no longer make their money off of bananas. I don't know what the ruling was. I haven't followed it. Is anyone here follow that?
No.
That would be an example. Now, the kind of power it has, to watch how that unfolds. If the ruling is made that England is non-WTO compliant, which is the technical terminology, then England can no longer buy most of its bananas from the Caribbean.
But
yes.
How is that enforced? Why can't England just say?
Because trade sanctions and fines. Like under NAFTA, when Exxon sued Canada, for the example to see how it's enforced and how powerful it is in a way is to look at NAFTA, because NAFTA's been in place longer. Exxon sued Canada because Canada made a ruling that a particular Exxon product could not be shipped through Canada because that product was toxic. It's a product that has been banned in California. California has banned the shipment of that product. But that had been previously banned in California. Exxon sued Canada because Canada said you can't move this product around. They sued Canada for something like $400 million. Exxon won and got a ruling of $243 million or something like that. And Canada paid.
And the ability then to cross Canada?
Yeah.
How did they win that? If a sudden say, okay, who is the trade?
So what you're really asking is what is the intricate mechanism of enforcement?
And who's the greedy people that thought of all this stuff?
Well, let's not think about the greedy. I mean, it's a good question, but it's so systemically intertwined. I mean, you could say it's the executives of Exxon, but then you can say, you know, Exxon's got to make its bottom line, and then why does Exxon need to make its bottom line? Because Wall Street wants fast profits. Why does Wall Street want fast profits? Because we want fast profits. So it's all intertwined. But so I don't think that it's any particular individual greedy people. It's the way we've agreed to a system and been blind to what's going on. Now, if we decide not to be blind, we can say agreements like the MAI shouldn't pass.
Right.
We should agreements like NAFTA. You know, if we had. How many people supported NAFTA before it happened and then subsequently don't?
Yeah.
Why did you decide not to support NAFTA?
Oh.
No, just a minute, does everyone know what NAFTA is? The North American Free Trade Agreement, which is largely around trade, not investment. But why did you decide you did and then you didn't?
I thought the supply and demand laws would work, but they sure get around those.
How did you see that?
Oh, I was down in southern Texas on a tour bus a couple of years ago, and we went into Mexico, and in that Mexican city there was a huge Fruit of the Loom company that was paying their people just a fraction of what the American workers were being paid, and I thought the Mexican people were being exploited, and I quit buying Fruit of the Loom, which maybe Hanes comes out of the same factory with a Hanes label. I don't know.
Well, in a sense, that's a beautiful example, because just the encounter with the Fruit of the Loom factory opened your eyes to something, and then you decided to use one part of your power as a human being your consumer power, to try to be a part of saying, I don't agree with this. You have a hand up right here.
I think they currently are having a battle over whether or not Mexican trucks have to meet American standards. So in other words, you can have trucks from Mexico rattling around our highways with no brakes and tough luck Charlie. You can't stop those trucks from coming in.
Well, this is NAFTA meets the Teamsters.
Oh, this is NAFTA meets the Teamsters. Good, okay, thank you, yes.
Is one of the underpinnings of these suits about expropriation of profits, is one of the arguments that the corporations say that they've already made an investment in the country under the assumption that such profits would be available? Or can a corporation without having made an investment, just go and assume before they put $1 into that country into an infrastructure?
I don't know the answer. I wish I have the MAI in my file at home. We also understand that democracy isn't a static thing. You know, it's something we've got to be involved in thinking through and understanding what it is and how it plays out in each new time and place. But if we see accountability and relative equality of power, in other words, the people in a place have relative equity in making decisions about the terms of life in that place, agreements like this are suspect. Or at least let me say, let's think about if they're suspect. Let us remember that.
none of this is fait accompli. That one of the powers within us is to become educated, aware, literate, and politically active. Do you know what the definition of the idiot was in Aristotle's writing? The definition of an idiot is a person, a non-political person. Political gets a bad name in our society. You know, I don't want to get involved in politics, da, da, da. But political, comes from the polis, you know, the city. Political has to do with being involved in shaping the common life. You might say the political is really holy ground for Christian people because it's being involved in shaping the common life together, the welfare of the polis. I only said that as a little plug that we're created political, we're created in community, and we're not created to be absent from shaping the life of the community. And we can do it around these economic issues. I know I'm talking a lot. Could we move on to freedom? And I'll talk less and we'll have a little bit more discussion.
But you're going to have to someday give us addresses and things that we can do. You're not going to do that? You're not going
to
give it?
Well, yes, I am. What I want to do in the last at least 10 minutes today is broach four principles for alternative global economic life. Just four principles. And then have us tomorrow, you know, between now and tomorrow, be thinking about things that would embody and enact those principles.
Okay, I'm going to ask one more question. How many of us are leaving tomorrow?
Oh, well, maybe we should just go right there.
It's 10:45. Yeah, we'll be here. Fast bus.
That's a slow one. You can change your
mind. If anybody is interested, I already have an email address of somebody who's left. If anybody's interested, I will be at the last session. If you want to give me an email address or a written address and you'd like me to send those to you that we come up with, I would be happy to do that.
Good.
Okay. Fast boat. That would be a good idea. That would be a lovely idea for fast boat people.
Yeah.
Okay. When does today's session end?
In 10 minutes. Got a lot of ground to cover there. I tell you what, let's just do a very abbreviated look at freedom. Let's just look at what we were going to look at. Would that work, folks? Mm-hmm. All I want to do around freedom is I want us to think about how we use the word freedom. And when we associate free with markets, or free with trade, or free with investment, we're associating the language of unalienable moral rights, one of our highest values. Well, I mean, if you rank the top five values as that you have as a person in this country, would freedom possibly rank in those?
Yes.
So what does it do to associate, what does it do to our psyches and our sense of what's right and good and moral to associate freedom with anything? My theory now is that when anyone says freedom, you need to say freedom for what, from what. I don't want to go there. I just want to read you some statements now that make this connect between market freedom and human freedom. And the point that I wanted us to dig into was to look at the way in which we have grown into and presupposed a sort of worldview that does link the two. So we link free international free trade and investment, that is unregulated, liberalized, open markets, with human freedom. So somehow to challenge the freedom of, for instance, money to go in and out of Chile, or in and out of Mexico, or in and out of Asia at the drop of a bucket. If we challenge that freedom, then we're challenging human freedom. We're jeopardizing human freedom. That's one of my theories. That we have an instinctual interest, that's a very good interest, in upholding freedom at almost all costs. But that maybe we're mistaken when we associate that freedom that should be upheld at all costs with all manifestations of free trade and investment. So just let me read you a couple of quotes that make that link. Here's a few from the International Chamber of Commerce. Deregulation, remember, what we're talking about freeing trade and investment, free, here's another, deregulate, liberalize, or open are all synonyms for this process. Deregulation and improvement of market access fosters
competitiveness and prosperity as the most reliable basis for individual freedom and dignity. So just as you hear these, think about, do I agree, do I disagree? What might be problematic, what might be deceptive in this statement? Deregulation of market access fosters competitiveness and prosperity as the most reliable basis for individual freedom and dignity. Here's another one. This is from the OECD that we talked about earlier. The case for open markets is based upon the human desire the world over for more rather than less freedom of choice, and is fueled by the idea that markets are supportive of enhanced freedom of individual and collective choice. Get the first part. The case for open markets is based upon the human desire the world over for more rather than less freedom of choice. So what kind of freedom of choice are they talking about? It obviously makes freedom of choice so I can choose from 40 kinds of cereal rather than three. But, okay, that's one. I'll read one more and then we'll talk about it. This is a voice from the far, far Christian right. Civil and religious freedom, progress, and the preservation of human rights are inextricably linked with economic freedom, with the right to own property, and with a minimum of state interference in economic affairs. State interference is regulations. If this freedom and flexibility of the business corporation is not protected, the entire society will suffer.
Worldwide?
Worldwide what?
Is that worldwide?
Is what worldwide?
The quote.
The quote is...
The meaning of it.
Well, it's a universalizing kind of statement. So those are just three. Am I the only one in the room that wonders about that? Those linkages between market freedom and human freedom?
Sure.
No.
Is it possible that that linkage is part of what diminishes our capacity to challenge, as a society, to challenge the notion that unmitigated market freedom is good for all? That's comments, questions, concerns related to that?
Yeah, we had deregulation and monopoly power distribution in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And with no competition, the prices went up and many suffered.
Are you talking about utilities powers?
Yes.
It's interesting how that one is a big, the last time we were in, or two times ago in this room, someone brought up deregulation recently of energy resources in California and the problems that's caused. So we could think about regulation and deregulation of public utilities and the pros and cons of both. I'm not here saying that all regulations are to be had. I'm only here saying that universally equating freedom, that is deregulation of markets, with human freedom is a questionable equation. I guess I would ask you to just put that in the consciousness for the next couple months of your life and see where freedom comes up and what mystifying connotations might be there when freedom is used around deregulated trade and investment. I want to keep the promise, I know there's a hand up, but I just want to, if I could, keep the promise to throw out some principles of alternatives. And if we had a lot more time, we would come up with these principles ourselves and other principles.
Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is a very old one.
You can ignore this down here. This was created for another activity. What I wanted to do, before even looking at those, I wanted to suggest that my experience with people the globe over is that people at all levels of society, top level scientists, top level business people, farmers, homeless people, peasants in various parts of the world, educators, are all coming up with alternative principles and practices.
and that part of our task is to become aware of them and think about them in our own localities, in the polis, in the public, in the body politic in which we're involved. I'm tossing out four here just for the sake of illustration and example. You could develop and think about others, or you are probably aware of others. Let's look at these, and then overnight in the days to come, think about public policies. Perhaps think about in your city or our country that might enact these kinds of principles, and then lifestyle practices that might enact them. One is, this is very, very broad, and we'll talk in, tomorrow's when we'll talk more in detail about these. This is just to toss them up. One is to suggest that the aim of economic life is to be just, sustainable, participatory communities and earth community. So that the aim of economic life shift from maximizing wealth or maximizing the production and consumption of goods, however you want to conceptualize it as it has been, to something very different. That the reason for trade and commerce, the reason for it, is to support just and sustainable and participatory communities. Is it acceptable for us, given the need to end relatively on time, to look at these four rather than discussing them?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Let's look at them, and then we'll put them on the plate for discussion, muse about them, and dream about them tonight, and then we'll talk more tomorrow. Two, economic policies and practices are to prioritize the needs of the vulnerable. That doesn't mean meet only the needs of the vulnerable, but to prioritize the needs of the vulnerable.
Can you lift that up a little?
Shirley, do you want to push it up a little bit? Thank you.
At the top.
You remember, oh, pop it down just a little bit again. Remember, I think it was 2 days ago, we talked about overall moral norms that our principles of economic life should aim at, and those are up at the top here. If the overall moral norms are justice, making neighbor love, and sustainable earth-human relations, then these are principles that might live towards those. Okay, the third one. Paul Hawken, is anyone familiar with Paul Hawken? The book, The Ecology of Commerce? Read the book. He's a very successful businessman who is a part of this movement toward a different kind of global economy. This is quoting him. Economic policies and practices are to aim at a system of commerce and production where each and every act is ecologically sustainable and restorative. Imagine that.
Push for that in the statements.
Just imagine that. And this statement comes out of the business community, not out of the out of any other community. It comes out of the business community. Four. Economic powers are to be accountable to the public as a body politic, not the public as just shareholders. Decisions regarding economic practices and policies are to be made with substantive input from the people most affected by them. Any initial questions, comments, or illustrations of these before we close, and then they will be on the plate for tomorrow.
Yes.
In Medford, Oregon, there was a company called Medco, owned a lot of timberland. And they had enough timber on that land to rotate it, manage it, so that they could sustain enough throughput through the mill for to make up 10,000 houses a year. It was sold out, and in order to make their payments and whatnot, they cut it all down. And instead of having a timber mill in town or timber economy, there's nothing left. It's all log.
So you're saying previously that business was closer to some of these policies, these principles.
That's right.
Does anyone have another example of business that meets or does seek to go by one or two of these principles? They're all over the place. I mean, in the world, not necessarily in our context. Yes.
Yeah, Nancy Amadei. I mean, it's not a business, but she's a social worker. I think from the University of Washington, she has principles for decency. I mean, I can't remember what she calls them, but living wage, living wage, daycare, and there are four of them. I can't remember them now.
Some of that work that you mentioned, you don't have it with you, do you?
I don't.
That would be interesting because it might exemplify some policies, some literal public policies that aim towards some of these. Okay. Let us tomorrow look at these principles, and what I'd like us to do is, you know, assess them also. You don't, if you think they're rotten, bring that up too. Think about other principles for economic life that might lead toward, realistically speaking, justice making neighbor love and sustainable earth human relations. And then let's think about lifestyle practices, public policies that cohere with some of these. And then the two other things I'd like to do tomorrow are to situate this entire discussion that we've been having a little bit in the way of doing, in a way of doing Christian ethics. That is a way of thinking about our moral life as Christian people. So that we situate this in a slightly bigger framework that we might be able to take with us and use in everyday life as time goes on. I'd like to do that situating a little bit. And then third, I'd like to do what I would planned on doing at the very beginning, which is interweave this discussion with some of Luther's economic ethics. Partly because this is a Lutheran retreat center, partly because I find it absolutely fascinating to read Luther's economic ethics, which are so radical. And I'll close by saying, I told this to a few people, I don't think everybody, that, did I tell you about the lecture I gave in South Dakota about Luther's economic ethics? I gave a lecture at Augustana College in South Dakota. It was called Luther and Earth Ethics or something, I can't remember. But I had been studying Luther's economic ethics at the... Oh, we'll talk about this tomorrow. I was studying his economic ethics at the same time, coincidentally, that the WTO protests were going on in Seattle. And lo and behold, a lot of Luther's statements looked like the same wording as the protesters' statements. So I jotted some of these down, and this is the truth. When I gave this lecture in Augustana, I asked the people in the auditorium to tell me to vote. I read some statements and asked them to vote. Is this Luther or is this from WTO protesters? I read some things. And they couldn't tell. Oh isn't that funny? No. Anyway, so I'd like to contextualize this a little bit, not only in Luther's economic ethics, but in Luther's theology of the indwelling power and presence of God, to empower us toward neighbor love. Literally, that Christ comes and lives in us, and that it is by that power and that power only that we become, never perfect, never morally righteous or anything like that, but we become more able to love neighbor as self because Christ living in us, loves neighbor within us. That is the theology, part of Luther's theology that I'd like to look at. Don't get me wrong, any of you who are going to be here tomorrow, I'm not saying that that's what saves us. I'm saying that that happens after we're made righteous by God, not as a part of being made righteous by God. It's not works righteousness, it's the result of our salvation by God through Christ. So thank you all, and again, I'm going to put in a plug for the book I just wrote.
Is it here yet?
It's not here yet.
Why not?
It's not here. You just have to write down the name of it.
We need better trade.